Deck Triathlon Show 262. Hey, what's up everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host Michael, and on today's episode I interview Dr. Inigo San Milan. Inigo is the head coach of World Tour Cycling Team UAE Team Emirates and the personal coach of Tour de France winner from this year 2020, Tadej Pogacar. He's also a professor at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, where he does clinical and research work in cellular metabolism. And this is not just exercise science, but actually a lot of his work is in things like diabetes, cardiometabolic disease, and cancer. So he really, really knows his cellular metabolism from all different perspectives that you can look at it. But importantly, of course, for our discussion, how to apply it in endurance performance. But before we get into the actual interview, I want to remind you of the Scientific Triathlon training camp that we're going to have between the 10th and 17th of April 2021 on Mallorca. You can find all the information on scientifictriathlon.com/camp. So go there and apply. I won't waste too much time talking about this here, but there is a lot of information on that page. So go and check it out and email me if you have any further questions. One thing that I do want to mention is that we have some extensive COVID-19 refund policies in place. So you can read all about that. But basically, you are pretty safe signing up for the camp. If for some reason it's not possible to travel to Mallorca, you will get your money back. So go and check that out. Also, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. If you listen to this episode as it comes out on Cyber Monday, then you still have today to get 20% off all electrolyte supplements by using the code TTSFriday20 on the website. And if you order for more than $100, then you get a free microfiber towel as well. So check that out, and of course, you know the deal. Go and take a free online sweat test to figure out what sort of strength you should have for your electrolytes to match your individual sweat sodium content. And a big thanks to Roka that you can find on roka.com. Roka is running a long holiday sales period all the way through the 1st of December. So actually, by the time you hear this, it's not that long anymore, but you still have 1 or 2 days to go. So go and check that out. If there are any items that you can't find on sale, of course, as usual, you can get 20% off of them with the promo code that you can get on roka.com/TTS. Please be aware that the promo code there can't be combined with items that are on sale. So for that, you just need to choose which one gives you the bigger discount. If you buy something that is on sale for a bigger discount than the 20% you can get through the TTS code, then please let Roka know that you came from Scientific Triathlon or from That Triathlon Show, because that helps keep the sponsors happy and keep the show sustainable. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Dr. Inigo San Milan. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Inigo. How are you doing today?
Good. Thank you very much, Mikael. Very nice to meet you.
You too. Thank you. And let's start by just you giving an introduction of yourself so that those who may not know who you are can get a better overview of who you are and what you do and so on.
So my name is Inigo San Milan, and I am a professor at the School of Medicine at the University of Colorado, and also in the Department of Physiology in our campus in Colorado Springs. And I've been for 25 years working with athletes of all kinds of sports and levels, mainly elite athletes and professional sports. And I also work in the area of research in cancer and diabetes at the School of Medicine. So I kind of combine both jobs right now.
That's something that I've found impressive in following you a bit, how you managed to combine the two, or the three, actually, like the academic side in both the general physiology, but also the cancer and general health, but then also the coaching side of things with your work with with the UAE cycling team on the World Tour, and among others, have coached Tadej Pogacar, who is the Tour de France winner of this year. So it's very impressive, all the things that you managed to combine.
Well, thank you. It's just the nice thing is that they all have one thing in common, right? Which is metabolism and physiology. So that's where it's much easier. They're not so different, right? And I think that I'm learning from each of the fields, and there's applications in each of the fields as well.
Yeah, we'll get into the metabolism and the physiology side a bit more in a little bit. But first, I would like to discuss some training principles. And so can you discuss what you would consider your main training principles, or an overview of how you view endurance training? And maybe if you have some different opinions when it comes to pros versus amateurs, then you can also go into that.
Yeah, well, thank you for the question. So in my modest opinion, I think it's about trying to address different energy systems. That's kind of how I view it. So we have the oxidative system, right? That's mainly based on the oxidation of fatty acids for energy purposes. Then we have the glycolytic system, which is about the utilization of glucose. And then we have also then the ATP phosphocreatine system. Right, which is it's energy that is anaerobic, doesn't need oxygen, and it's energy stored in the muscles already in the form of ATP. That's how I address it. So all the systems are important. Specifically, the important ones are the oxidative system and the glycolytic system. The glycolytic system is the one that obviously it's very necessary and important to win a competition. That's kind of what I call the turbo, if you will. But it needs the oxidative system to function. The oxidative system is mainly happens in the slow twitch muscle fibers, and the glycolytic system mainly happens in the fast twitch muscle fibers. But in the fast twitch muscle fibers, the end product, not a waste product, but the end product of the glycolytic system is always lactate. Is the mandatory byproduct or end product. And that lactate needs to be cleared out of the fast twitch muscle fibers. And it's cleared by the slow twitch muscle fibers mainly and in the mitochondria. And that's where the mitochondria is key to improve that oxidative system as well as to clear lactate.
Yeah, I think it's something that over recent years, people are becoming more and more familiar with the fact that lactate is not a waste product and not a negative substance that we have, but actually a positive, a fuel. It's used for fuel, as you say. So, but it's good that to hear it once again, and you explained it very well, how it goes, is shuttled from the fast twitch fibers to the slow twitch fibers. How different demands are there on the glycolytic system for somebody who is maybe a sprinter or a breakaway specialist in cycling terms versus a general classification rider or climber or something like that? How different demands do they have on that system?
I think that all demands are important. Like let's say a climber rider or a GC rider has to travel through the competition with a very good metabolic efficiency. And for that, they need to be very good at oxidizing fats for energy purposes in the mitochondria. And also then need a very good glycolytic capacity to put out 400 watts, for example, on a climb. And as we mentioned, you know, that's going to produce lactate. And lactate is not, again, the problem of lactate is not lactate itself, is the hydrogen ions associated to lactate. Those are the ones that accumulate and elicit an acidosis in the microenvironment of the muscle. And also the lactate itself, it's a signaling molecule. And when it accumulates without being oxidized, is probably not good. That's something that we're seeing very clearly in cancer. It's a major driver of carcinogenesis. But when it comes to sports performance, that's something that you don't want to accumulate lactate. You want to use it for energy. And that's what you need to oxidize it in other fibers, in this case, slow twist muscle fibers, into fuel. So that's a system that's very important for the GC guy. For the sprinter, in a way, they also have to travel through the race more metabolically efficient than others. Many times, you know, the guy who is the fastest in the sprint might not be the fastest sprinter, but maybe the freshest who arrived to the finish line, or the last 200 meter, the freshest, or even the last 2 kilometers, 3 kilometers in the race, they're really, really hard, really difficult. So if you arrive there cooked, there's not much you can do. And I've seen this multiple times, someone who can put out 1,800 watts in a sprint, but in a race, they cannot do more than 1,300 or 1,400 watts. And that's because they're not very good at, they're not metabolically efficient, and they travel through the race producing a lot more lactate. So, but if they arrive fresh, yes, that's where they have that sprint capacity, and that's that ATP PC system that is anaerobic, and there's a lot of genetics behind it. There's a lot of training as well, but this is what I think, that whether you are a GC rider or you're a sprinter in a sport like cycling, you need to be complete in all the energy systems.
And do you think that amateur athletes, let's say people focusing on half and full distance triathlons or longer gravel races in cycling or marathon running, that sort of thing, do they also need to focus on striving for being complete and really focusing on all the energy systems in the same way?
I would say so, except for sprinting, right? In my opinion, you know, and this is one thing that I focus on, those three energy systems, right? Is that, yeah, if you're a soccer, a football player, or a basketball player, or a sprinter, you need, you know, the sprinting capacity. If you are a marathon runner or a triathlete, you know, when are you going to sprint? Right, chances are that you might not even sprint ever, you know. And even if you have to sprint in the last 200 meters, in the event that you arrive after a marathon to a sprint situation, it's not a full sprint. It's more about being faster, because at that time you're so fatigued that it's very difficult to deploy the high sprinting capacity. So, you know, sometimes when I see this type of athletes training the sprinting capacity all the time, at least once or twice a week, doing sprints and sprints, I wonder, like why, right? What's the principle behind that? Because they're never going to use that energy system, and it's going to take time away, specifically from triathlon, time away from cultivating the other energy systems, which are key, right? And on top of that, it poses an extra physiological stress on the body, specifically when it comes to the triathlete. It's important to improve the fat oxidation, but the glycolytic capacity as well. Like when you do a marathon at competition pace, we sometimes think, many times think that, oh, this is fat burning mode, right? Or when you do like the bike part of the Ironman. But the reality is that the glycolytic component is huge. So that's why it's very important to work those both energy systems.
Got it. So if we discuss a bit around what that looks like in terms of training, and maybe you want to start actually from the testing, because I know that you do a lot of testing, lactate testing. So perhaps you can start there and tell us a little bit more about the testing that you do and how that then informs training decisions.
Yeah, so I like to do like complete metabolic testing, where I look at, try to have a picture of what's the metabolic map of an athlete, what's the muscle fiber recruitment patterns, what's the substrate utilization, what's the lactic clearance capacity. So I started changing protocols too. And about 20 years ago, I started like a longer protocol as opposed to the short protocols, 1 or 3 minute intervals, intervals every stage. And I do like about 10 minutes increments, right, until exhaustion. And I do 10 minutes because I like to observe how different athletes respond and how it can discriminate. So for example, if you look at lactate and you do like a protocol that is 1 minute long or even 3 minutes long, it's very possible that the lactate you're getting from the current step might be a reflection of what happened in the previous step. However, if you do like a 10-minute long protocol, that's where you're sure that the lactate you're getting is from this actual step, right? So this is one of the things that, and also discriminates. You know, you see like, let's say with two athletes and at minute three, at 300 watts, for example, right? At minute three of that stage, both athletes have 3 millimoles of lactate. So the conclusion might be that they're similar, metabolically speaking. However, you see that one athlete, 7 minutes later, that is at minute 10, is still at 3 millimoles of lactate. So it's very steady state for that athlete, whereas the other athlete might be already at 7. And that's where you see that there's a huge discrimination between 7 millimoles and 3 millimoles. So this is one of the things that I like to do when it comes to the length of the protocol. Then, as I mentioned, I look at lactate because it's a very good surrogate for what's the metabolic efficiency of an athlete. If you see higher lactate appearing in blood, it means that there's not enough lactate clearance capacity in the muscles. The fast twitch muscles produce lactate as a result of a combustion of glycolysis, glucose, and that lactate preferably is oxidized in the adjacent muscle fibers, which are the type 1 muscle fibers within the mitochondria. So if you have a good mitochondrial capacity and function in the slow twitch muscle fibers, you're going to oxidize that lactate right there within the muscle, and it's not going to be exported to the blood as much. So when you see blood appearing, lactate appearing in the blood, it means that you're losing that lactate clearance capacity. That's, for example, what I mentioned in that earlier in that 10-minute interval. If by minute three, both cyclists have, or runners, they have 3 millimoles, okay, that's good, but I want to see what happens 7 minutes later. And in fact, you see 7 minutes later, one of the athletes still at 3 millimoles. That means that they're oxidizing lactate very well, and the other one is losing the lactate oxidation in the mitochondria and starts building up in the muscle, so there's no other choice than sending them to the blood. I like to see what's the substrate utilization. So nowadays, through stoichiometric equations with metabolic CART, we can get to see what's the fat and carbohydrate oxidation. So I started doing this about 15 years ago, and I remember that a lot of people thought it was a crazy idea. But now this is the common thing to do, looking at fat and carbohydrate oxidation rates, because it shows you too, you know, what is the metabolic efficiency of that athlete? Is that athlete oxidizing a lot of fat, therefore is in a very oxidative situation, or is already utilizing a lot of carbohydrates for energy purposes? And furthermore, it can help us also to dial in the nutrition. So looking at these observations, for example, about 12 years ago, I started to recommend new nutritional guidelines. So the previous nutritional guidelines called for 30 to 50 grams per hour of carbohydrates in longer events over 3 hours. But looking at all this data, I started to recommend 80 to 100 grams per hour because I thought that this cannot, you know, athletes, they oxidize a lot more than what we've been told for decades with this former guidelines. So yeah, that's what I started to use, 80 to 100 grams an hour. And again, like back then, you know, I was highly criticized by some of the nutrition gurus around the world because it was impossible to do this. And now, you know, many of these same people now, they're who were criticizing me, they're now giving conferences and writing guidelines about using 80 to 100 grams per hour, right? So, yeah, it's something that it's a big deal to have like a carbohydrate consumption of 100 grams per hour versus 30, and it really makes a difference. But again, this is something that we got through looking at fat and carbohydrate oxidation rates during exercise as part of the protocol, which I do this all the time.
So when it comes to the lactate itself, the lactate concentration that you measure is obviously a function of the production and the clearance. But it's not possible to know exactly which is which. You might have an athlete that produces a lot but also clears a lot, or an athlete that produces little and clears little. So do you, in some ways, do you go to all out, basically try to elicit the maximum lactate concentration that you can see, or do you have any other tricks when it comes to finding out whether an athlete has that strong glycolytic capacity in the first place to produce lactate?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so for that, my colleague, mentor, and great friend, George Brooks, from the University of California in Berkeley, he has done extensive research in lactate. And pretty much everything that we know about lactate comes from his research work for over 40 years. So he's shown that well-trained athletes, and then others have shown and confirmed that well-trained athletes, they produce more lactate because their glycolytic capacity also is stronger. And therefore, your glycolytic capacity is better. You're going to be producing more lactate. That said, your lactate clearance capacity, your oxidation capacity is much better as well. So sometimes we see, or we tend to think, oh, this athlete at, let's say, 350 watts is not producing lactate. That's kind of how times, let's say, I'm sorry, I reverse, like we see like 350 watts and an athlete has, let's say, 3 millimoles of lactate or 2.5, right? So we might think that that athlete is not producing lactate, where actually it's probably that he or she is producing tremendous amount of lactate, but it's clearing out very well. So that's what normally know that when you're pedaling at 350, 400 watts, you know, the glycolytic capacity is enormous. So when you see an athlete whose lactate is not much, that means that that doesn't mean that it doesn't produce lactate. It produces tremendous amount of lactate because, again, glycolysis cannot happen without lactate, and but it's very good at clearing the lactate. I don't know if that addresses the question.
The one or the part of the question at least was whether you actually go to maximum to test their maximum lactate concentration. Like, do you test that, or is it not important?
Oh yeah, great question. Yeah. So yes, what I've seen is that glycolytic athletes, like for example, rowers. Rowing is it's an incredible sport, very, very difficult, very hard. And the Olympic distance is 2,000 meters. So we're talking about when you work in a boat, right, with eight, we're talking, it's about 6 minutes. So, and you move you use pretty much every single muscle in the body, right? And these athletes are characterized by having tremendous glycolytic capacity. And you see maximal lactates of, 15, 17, 20 millimoles. And that's something that I observe. When you do the same test, or a maximal test, I'm sorry, to a marathon runner, for example, you're not going to see 17 millimoles, 20 millimoles normally, right? You might see 8 millimoles, 9 millimoles, 12 millimoles. And the same thing we can see, in a cyclist as well. So endurance athletes, they tend to have a lower glycolytic capacity compared to like a rower, for example, or a swimmer, like a 100-meter swimmer, for example. But to your question, when it comes specifically to endurance athletes, I don't pay much attention to the maximum lactate, but I also pay attention to that. So what I mean, I don't pay much attention to that lactate because normally that super, super high glycolytic capacity, which is close to an anaerobic effort, that's something you don't deploy in the competition much. However, it's important. I like to see what's the maximum lactic capacity of that athlete, because if it's very depressed, the maximum lactate, it's a sign of fatigue and glycogen depletion. So if an athlete, if you do a test to an athlete, and I always take them to the tent, or normally tend to take them to the max, if that athlete normally has 10 millimoles of lactate, maximal lactate, and today that athlete has 4, which is quite common to see, that athlete has a decreased, has a fatigued and decreased glycogen content. So it's a good way to see this, and therefore also you see that they also have lower maximum heart rate, which is another thing that I like to see, because they go together. Maximum heart rate and maximum lactate, they go absolutely together, I would say 99.9% of the times at maximum efforts. And if you don't have a, if you have a big decrease in maximum lactate compared to what you usually have, you're also going to have a decrease in maximum heart rate, which means that you're fatigued and glycogen depleted. So that's what I like to see, this parameter, more than just to see, well, maximum lactate is 15 or 10 or 12. I don't care so much about it for endurance athletes, right? But I care more about to see what's the status of fatigue or of training. Yeah.
So if we discuss how you prescribe the training for athletes you coach, and perhaps we can take the perspective of like a GC rider, somebody who's more on the, like, more similar to the majority of this audience, which is triathletes. We have a lot of cyclists and runners and so on as well. But let's take a GC rider as an example, because it makes it more similar. So what would a typical training, like just the overarching principles for how you lay out the training, what would that be?
Yeah, so my vision, and it's about, I really like the kind of 80-20 polarized training approach, right? That if you look at historically the workload of the top athletes in the world in endurance sports, and even not endurance sports, like, again, like rowers or swimmers, what 80% of the time they're more in the lower intensities, and about 20% is very high intensities. So to me, that's a principle that I've seen over and over, that's kind of what it works. And within the 80% of that lower intensity, is not that it's just going and ride for fun, right? I break it down into different training zones. So zone one would be like, yeah, the very low intensity recovery day, if you will. Zone two, that's kind of the sweet spot, which where I have seen over the years that it increases performance dramatically if you do things right. You increase lactic cleanse capacity and fat oxidation, and it's because you're hitting or stimulating that energy system to the fullest, which is the oxidative energy system. And this is where I concentrate a lot working with athletes.
Can you define where that zone two is? Is it like around what we might call the first lactate threshold or the first ventilatory threshold, or where is it?
Yes, thanks for the question. So I match these both with fat oxidation as well as with inflection of lactate. And normally, almost always, they coincide. So the zone two, it coincides with that first inflection of lactate from resting levels or from easy intensity. And at the same time, it coincides with the maximum fat oxidation, that fat max. Yep. And this is the metabolic event that is very important, because that is suggesting that the body is, let's say, that oxidative capacity is working full on, right? When you go to zone three, you observe a big change in fat oxidation, where it's a big drop, and then there's like also a big increase in carbohydrate oxidation. And at the same time, therefore, you also see an inflection, an important inflection point in lactate or increase in lactate. So that is telling us there is like another metabolic event. And that tells you that athlete is starting to deploy or recruit those glycolytic muscle fibers. And that's where you're utilizing then more glucose than fat. And then this that's kind of what I call the zone three, which is a little bit of a transition between that zone two and that zone four, which is the zone four is what we would call that the threshold, because it's full-blown glycolytic activity. You can sustain it for a bunch of minutes. It depends on where you set it. But the whole thing of zone four is that what we typically see is that there's another inflection point in lactate, and then it's also like a sharp decrease in fat oxidation. And in fact, there's no more fat oxidation usually at that intensity, because all the ATP is derived from a carbohydrate source. So that's where I set up those main zones, right? The zone two recovery, zone two, that's kind of the sweet spot for mitochondrial training, if you will, and or oxidative training. Zone 3 is like where you start seeing more and more glycolysis predominant over oxidation. Mm-hmm. I mean, oxidative phosphorylation. And then you start seeing a zone 4 that is just fully glycolytic. And then zone 5 is another transition towards the zone 6, which is the pure anaerobic. It's like a 1 minute maximum or so. But the zone 5 is, it's kind of will be close to your VO2 max, right? This is the maximum intensity that it's coming from oxygen. And then zone 6 is pure anaerobic intensity where there's no oxygen need for energy purposes.
Within the roughly 80% of low intensity, how do you distribute the training between zone 2 and zone 1 work?
That's a very good question. So I try to have like at least 1 day a week. I mean, I'm sorry, at least so 2 days a week recovery. 1 day a week, I like to have a completely off day, which especially is important for runners or you know, it's another day where you don't force, you know, like more, you know, the weight bearing, you know, of running, and you can give one extra day to recover. And cyclists, the same thing, or runners. I mean, or swimmers. Any athlete I work with, I highly recommend 1 day off completely. Which again was a concept that 15, 20 years ago it was crazy to imagine an athlete having a complete day off. And now, pretty much everybody at the highest level in the sport is doing it. So I like that, and then I like another zone 1 day, like a recovery day, easy recovery day. And so with that, we have 2 days. But then I like to see, it depends on which phase of the season, I like to do 3 to 4 days at zone 2. If we're talking about like the preseason training, and once the season starts, I like to do 2 to 3. And then, you know, zone 4 and 5, I like to do that once a week. And again, you know, what we were talking about sprints, you know, I don't personally, and this is my personal, you know, I don't do sprints with my athletes. Like Pogacar doesn't do sprint training, for example, or triathletes, you know, they don't tend to do sprint training. I don't like to recommend that because it's difficult to fit in all these energy systems. And again, it's something that if you're not a sprinter, I don't see much rationale to work on your sprint capacity when you really need to improve other energy systems. Mm. So that's why I distribute it. Depends on the phase of the season.
Yeah. Can you describe a bit more how the high intensity training, what it might look like in the preseason, and then maybe when we get into race season, how it changes?
Yeah. The high intensity training in the preseason, I might do it once a week, specifically 1 day dedicated to do intervals, glycolytic intervals. And it depends on the sport, right? If we're talking about a rower, yeah, they have to be closer to about 6 minutes, right? Which is their distance that they're going to be competing. When we're talking about a cyclist, for example, you might want to do like about 15 to 20 minutes, and later on you might do more, right? But I try to, you know, adjust it to kind of the duration of the effort. You know, I don't like much to do like 1 or 3 minutes glycolytic training or 5 minutes intervals for a cyclist, because that, you know, they tend to need more time than that. That doesn't mean that I get rid of them completely, but I tend to adjust that glycolytic training to the intensity of the one they're going to be working at. And that might be once a week at the beginning of the season, and maybe it's twice a week during the right before the season, or during a specific macro cycle where they're preparing a given competition. Or what I do quite often too, I also build some glycolytic training into an oxidative training session. So you stimulate two energy systems within one session. Mm. But again, this is quite, normally when you do the zone 2 training, it's quite demanding. It's not just riding or running easy. It's very demanding. And when you add high intensity training, obviously that's quite demanding. So it's very important to build good recovery days.
Would you do the hard part if you build in the glycolytic training into an endurance day? Would you do that glycolytic training at the start or at the middle or at the end, or maybe all three of them? How would you spread it out within the workout?
Yeah, that's a great question. I try to simulate what happens in the competition. So in this case, you know, normally, you know, that I would like to do it towards the end of the training or in the middle, but usually I don't tend to do it at the beginning.
Mm. And we, since your intervals for cyclists, if we're talking about that, are tend to be longer, the glycolytic intervals, does that mean that what is the intensity? Is it kind of like right around quote unquote threshold, just below it, or just above it? What is the intensity level if you specify that a bit?
Yeah, thank you. So, in that first phase of the season, like the preseason, I do zone three, zone four, then more zone four, and that's what I usually get to stay there for a while, right? Zone four, and then I add more zone five or, you know, above the threshold. So, like at first, it's a mixture below threshold and threshold, then it's more threshold, and then it's a mixture of threshold and above threshold. That's specifically for a cyclist. And I try to do have, again, durations that are closer to what the competition does. So at the beginning, we might do 15 minutes or 10 minutes, and then we might do 20, and then we might do even 40, right? Or for example, if you're preparing for a time trial, like in the case of Pogacar, we knew that the time trial at the Tour de France where he won, right? And he did a great race. He trained it already. It's not that he showed up and, oh, boom, I did a great time trial, right? He practiced the time trial quite a bit, both in the recognition of the same parkours, you know, in France, but also we practiced it training. So we were talking about, you know, close to about 50 to an hour, you know, 50 minutes to an hour. So we've been doing those trainings also specifically, very glycolytic training, super hard training, but, you know, close to an hour long, right? And the same thing for the time trial when he won the Slovenian championships. This is about, if I remember correctly, it was about 40 minutes. So that's what we do, 40 minute intervals, you know, or interval, a full time trial, right? But it is about try to simulate the time of the competition at the one you're going to be competing at.
Yeah, race specificity is important, it sounds like.
Yes.
Right. And if we talk about amateur endurance athletes, so this overview that you've been describing now, do you think that it works well for amateur athletes as well? Well, only that, of course, their volume is smaller, so it's scaled down. But generally speaking, do you think that the same principles apply?
Absolutely. In my opinion, the same principles apply. And as you said very well, the volume might be lower, but the same principles apply. And I've seen this over and over and over in all kinds of athletes for 25 years, that they apply beautifully. And to that question too of the volume, there's the myth is out there that, you know, that, oh, I only have an hour and a half to train or 2 hours to train. I can't do endurance because it requires 5-6 hours, right? I don't have that time. So in just an hour and a half or two, I'm just going to go full out and do interval training. But at an amateur level or recreational level, 1.5-2 hours, they can really move the needle in terms of improving that mitochondrial function and the lactic clearance capacity, right? So I really think that I have seen it over and over. It's you can extrapolate it perfectly to amateur athletes.
I don't think that you've coached triathletes specifically, but one interesting challenge with triathlon is that, of course, you had three different disciplines. So generally speaking, it tends to be that triathlon training programs do end up having more frequent intense workouts because you try to fit in an intense swim and a bike and a run.
Yeah.
What's your take on that? Like, how would you solve that puzzle?
Yeah. So, yeah, I've been coaching triathletes, and it's a, I would say it's the most challenging form of coaching, right, that I've seen, because as you said very well, you have three disciplines, you have to try to, it's a puzzle, as you said very well, right? And in my opinion, again, the one thing that I do with triathletes, I'm very more radical when it comes to high intensity. I just kind of don't do that anymore. And what I mean high intensity is like sprints or very short intervals, right? Because that's an energy system that you're never going to use in the competition. So again, as I said earlier, why training that? And why specifically? Because you have so many other energy systems in different modalities where you need to focus on. When I see athletes training, sprint training every week on each of the modalities, that's three sessions, right, of sprinting, where that athlete really needs to improve that glycolytic capacity or the especially the mitochondrial function. So you don't have, I mean, you're subtracting sessions from what you really need, right? So I try to really focus more on that. On the other hand, what I've seen is that triathletes are the population that are the most overtrained by far from what I see, because I see this all the time. And that's where like they have so many extra stressors that, in my opinion, they're not needed. And again, the major stressor is the high intensity training and the intervals that, again, they're not going to use it in their competition. And it's an extra physiological stress. So I try to focus more on the juice of the sport, right?
Yeah, well, it's super interesting to hear you say that. Definitely, definitely, really, really fascinating perspective. You've talked a lot about the mitochondrial function being best developed by the zone two training, and that's of course one important part of the athlete's aerobic capacity or their VO2 max, if you want to call it that. Another part is the stroke volume. And I think what a lot of athletes and coaches try to get at with shorter intervals, like 3-minute intervals, 4-minute intervals, 2-minute intervals, is to improve the stroke volume or the central adaptations of VO2 max. What's your take on that? Mm-hmm. Can it still be improved with other means other than the really high intensity intervals with perhaps longer and slightly less intense intervals that are more specific to the race? Or how do you think about that?
Yeah, so my opinion on the central adaptations versus the local adaptations is that the ones that rule in an elite athlete or well-trained athlete are the local adaptations. And that's why the VO2 max, in my opinion, is not a big component or a very important component. And this is what I've seen all the time for 25 years, where you can see two athletes of, let's say, triathletes of high level, right? And one of them has an incredible high VO2 max, but the other one is an okay VO2 max, but the other athlete is better. And when you come down to the local adaptations at the cellular level, looking, for example, again, at lactate clearance capacity or fat and carbohydrate oxidation rate, the lower VO2 max athlete might perfectly be much better. So that's what I started to see, like, wow, VO2 max doesn't really predict performance. And I'm not the only one seeing it. Many people doing a lot of metabolic testing, they see this all the time. So that's what I don't think that is so important. And in fact, right now we're going to publish soon. We have finished all the data analysis looking at the differences between VO2 and lactate. VO2 at even a given power outputs as well as maximum VO2 max. And there's little correlation between VO2 max and lactate, which is, again, confirming what we have seen over the years, that like you and I can have the same VO2 max, but at 300 watts, you might have 3 millimoles of lactate and I might be at 7 millimoles of lactate. So you're a much better athlete than I am, but my VO2 max might be as good as yours. So that's where like the VO2 max doesn't discriminate. It's more of the local adaptation. So this is why I don't focus so much on the VO2 max. That's my personal opinion. And again, we're going to prove this concept in a study that hopefully we will be publishing next year.
Yeah, well, you explained that really, really well. And it's a question that I've asked quite a lot recently on the podcast to different guests. What is more important, central or peripheral adaptations? And I think this is probably the most in-depth answer that I've gotten so far. So really interesting. When it comes to actually prescribing training, do you use power mostly, or heart rate, or RPE, or a combination? How do you do that?
That's a very good question. So I really like the combination. In fact, I've been using, before we had power output, we had heart rate, right? And then the power meters came along, and about especially 10, 12 years ago, they became very popular, training by power. And working with elite athletes, I kept observing that those ones only training by power, they kept getting overtrained and fatigued. And I started to also to try to understand why, right? And the thing is that the ability of humans to produce energy depends on the ability of to convert chemical energy into mechanical energy. When you look at only at the power output, you're just looking at the end product, which is the mechanical energy, and you might miss different parameters there. For example, heart rate, you know, and I was told, like, you know, 10 years ago, I was really trying to stop, you know, it's just training by power output. And a lot of people were telling me that I was old school. Oh, you're training heart rate. That's super old school. Well, heart rate is a true physiological parameter, right? It's reflecting what happens in the body. And power output is not a physiological parameter. It's that mechanical end product, you know, as a result of all the physiological parameters in place. So it's a great surrogate heart rate for what happens in the body. And that's why I have a study, I haven't published it. I presented at the ACSM conference in 2009 or 2008, so long, like, yeah, 12 years ago, showing that watts are not watts. And this is a myth that has been going on for years, where like people, they would argue when only using power output that, hey, watts are watts, that's it, you know, like, sure. But that doesn't mean that the same, you know, metabolic processes to get to the same power output are the same. And this is why I did the study looking at, a group of athletes, exercising at the same power output over time. And while the power output did not change, and it was higher intensity too, it was like a zone four or so, the metabolic parameters increased dramatically. So we saw a big increase in lactate, a big increase in heart rate, and a big increase in oxygen consumption. So the power didn't change, and sure, watts are watts, right? But metabolically speaking, there was a big change. And that's what I would see, that maybe some people are prescribed power. Let's say you have to train at, 200 watts for 3 hours. And maybe the first hour, the body is handling those 200 watts. But, you know, many people in an hour and a half, then you're at a whole different metabolic situation. So instead of going to zone two, for example, you might be going to zone three. And by the end of the 2.5 hours, you might be already into the zone four, and you don't see it if you just look at watts. So you get home, you say, hey, I did 200 watts as my coach told me, but you pay a big price because you started zone two and you ended up at zone four. And this is why I would see a lot of people getting overtrained and fatigued. So what I've been championing for all these years is to look at both. And this is something that Joe Friel mentioned about the coupling, right? Where you want to see the heart rate and the power output are completely, you know, coupled together, right? And when you see a deviation of both, well, you can just then analyze it differently. But I think that, in my opinion, they should go together. And again, you know, when you're training, and besides the cardiac drift, which if you are well hydrated, you know, you should not go 20 beats per minute. You know, that's why the zone two in heart rate, I give people like 10, you know, like within 10 beats per minute, let's say 120 to 130 beats per minute, for example, right? But you're not going to go, the cardiac drift is not going to go from 120, that's it, that your prescribed training is not going to go to 140, 150 under normal conditions. But if you look at that at your same, let's say 200 watts, you start at 120, and an hour and a half later, you're at 145. That's not cardiac drift. That's metabolic stress. And that's what, okay, you might want to, you're not adapted there yet. So you might want to look at your heart rate and decrease your power output. Does it make sense?
Yes, it does. It does. And it brings us back to the testing, because obviously that's where you determine the heart rate and the powers that you prescribe. And one thing that I wanted to ask about is that not everybody lives in Colorado with access to your 10-minute testing protocol. What advice do you have for amateurs regarding how they should be testing and using that to inform their training, keeping in mind that they are spread out all over the world?
Yeah, so I would I see that more and more exercise physiology laboratories are being open or are offering this testing. I would check with your local university, or maybe there's a sports medicine center, or to be honest, more and more coaches, they can also do this testing, right? They might have a studio, and they might have a, you don't need a very expensive ergometer in the laboratory like we use, which is $20,000 ergometer, and another $25,000 of the metabolic cart. But you know, the smart trainers are very good now. They're overall quite close to what we see in the laboratory, so you can do this test. And again, you don't need to look at metabolic cart necessarily. I think looking at lactate, it's a very good tool, because it's a very good surrogate of what happens at the cellular level. But I really think, and this is my experience with athletes, is that especially in Europe, not much here in the United States, but especially in Europe, most of the major cities, I would say in any country of the Europe, they have these facilities. So I would encourage people to contact multiple sports medicine center, universities, exercise physiology labs, because I'm very sure they're going to find these laboratories and already doing these protocols.
Yeah. What do you think about, I do see a fair amount of labs that have short protocols, like 3-minute steps in the incremental test and so on, maybe 4-minute tests. And you're pretty lucky if you find 5-minute tests. Maybe in some cases you can just ask them to do a 5-minute test, but in some cases it might just be that they try to cram through a lot of people in a short amount of time. So what is the minimum step duration that you would recommend?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I would say at least 5 minutes. That's what I would like to see. I see definitely 1 minute is, in my modest opinion, is you're not going to get much data. 3 minutes, not much data. But 5 minutes, I think you were going to get good data. You pass that, you need about 3 minutes to, when you change the step into a higher intensity, you need a good 3 minutes, for to get used to that change physiologically, metabolically. So I would say 3 minutes is the minimum barely to do this. But I think that 4 minutes might be tight, but I think 5 minutes is a very good way to start. And in fact, I tend to do, for example, with some of the runners, I do 5-minute intervals. Because what I see in running in 5 minutes, you have a very good knowledge of other metabolism response within 5 minutes. So I would say 5 minutes works also.
Mm. And if for whatever reason testing isn't an option, it might be financial reasons or just living somewhere where there really isn't anything, what's your opinion on the next best choice? Are there field tests that you think are better than others, or even using things like the talk test that has been described in research? Yeah. What would you recommend if lab testing is not an option?
That's a great question too, and I think that the talk test is a great test. It's in my opinion is much more accurate than most VO2 max tests, right? And the talk test is the same thing. It reflects a metabolic event. When you can, let's say, run or ride, and you can talk like you and I now, right? That means that you're not doing much effort. So that's your zone one right there, right? When you are having difficulty talking but still can talk, you're probably at the zone two, and usually coincides. This is something that I've learned also, testing a lot of people in the laboratory when they talk to you, right? And and I kind of tend to tease them and, hey, talk to me. I like to see those feelings as well to confirm these things too. So that would be your zone two, difficulty talking to someone, but you can still talk. Your zone three is kind of... you're struggling a lot. You know, you have to catch your breath all the time. You cannot have a normal conversation. You're struggling tremendously. And then your zone four is like, you cannot even talk anymore, right? So I think, honestly, and call me old school, right, if you want to, but I think the talk test, it could be quite accurate.
Yeah, no, I agree. And to me, it's something in those endurance workouts that is also like a secondary or a joint primary metric, to be honest, for intensity control alongside heart rate and pace or power, depending on which sport it is. So I do agree that it's very important. We're running a bit short on time, but I do have a couple more questions that we'll try to go
through. Well, I have more time if you want.
All right. Yeah, just a few more. Yeah. Three questions that I'd like to get to. One is around fueling. You mentioned racing already, but what about training? What's your recommendations around fueling in training? And are there any points where you recommend deliberately not fueling training?
Yes, that is the whole thing of trying to restrict, right? There's a lot of hype about that, right? I must say that this hype is not new, right? When I was 15 years old and I started riding my bike, that we're talking about over 30 years ago, more than 34, we were doing that also. We were restricting carbohydrates during training. I remember our cycling sports director, knew about a French guy and back in the day, France was like the ultimate science of the sport. And that French coach was recommending athletes not to eat a lot of carbohydrates during training, because this way we would train our bodies to use fat, right? So these concepts, they were not new at all, right? But every 20, 30 years or so, these concepts they're coming back, but they're rebranded somehow, right? But my experience is that this doesn't work overall. There are a few reasons. First, because let's say a triathlete, that they have to do a lot of fasting training or restricting training. That's a metabolic stress to start with, and they don't have much room for extra metabolic stressors in training. Second, there's no research whatsoever showing that if you decrease carbohydrate intake during training, you're going to increase mitochondrial function and burning more fat. There's no research. There's some research that shows that you might increase some of the RNA for the genes encoding the proteins involved in mitochondrial function, but not in the proteins per se. And sometimes we see that the fact that you have an increase in the RNA expression, that doesn't mean that you're going to be producing the protein, to produce that mitochondria. So there's no research. And what I see all the time is that there's a lot of extra stressors. And the third thing I like to point out is that if you tell an athlete to do, okay, go today and do an hour and a half hours without, fasting, without breakfast or anything like that, they're going to push the envelope, and they're going to do two, or they're going to do three, or they're going to do five. So in my opinion, it doesn't work.
All right, perfect. And the next question is, do you prescribe training at different cadences? And if you do, when and why would you prescribe low and high cadences?
That's a good question. And to be honest, I would not know what to tell you. I don't know. I would not know what's the perfect cadence for an athlete. I would not know. I think that some exercise, some sessions, you could use more like a bigger, harder gears, right? To increase, power and try to simulate what you would do instead of weights. You could do the same session on the bike, but recruiting specifically the muscle fibers that you're doing specifically to the sport. That's what I do here and there. But again, I'm not an expert at this, and I would not probably give you the best answers for that.
That's fair enough. No problem. And for the final question that before we go into the rapid fire questions is, how important do you consider an athlete's phenotype be, or their muscle fiber distribution and so on, for training and recovery? And probably you don't take too many muscle biopsies of your athletes, but you probably have a like an idea, an estimate based on the testing that you do and just their general profile and how they behave. So can you talk a little bit more about phenotype and athlete profiling?
So that's a great question. And I think that we used to think that that phenotype was key, right? If you have a more percentage of slow twitch muscle fibers or fast twitch muscle fibers. But I think that the muscle's plasticity is unbelievable. And I think more than the distributions, the phenotype, which is going to be overall even, I mean, it's not going to be 50-50, right? But it's not going to be 90-10 either, right? So it's a little bit of equilibrium. But more than the distribution, my opinion is like the function. It's like, you might have like a higher fast twitch muscle fibers than slow twitch muscle fibers, which is an advantage for glycolytic efforts. But the function of the slow twitch muscle fibers might be amazing because they're mitochondrial function. And therefore, that's where you're even at a higher advantage. Or you might have a higher proportion of slow twitch muscle fibers, and the function is very good. And then your glycolytic capacity from the fast twitch muscle fibers might not be as good now, but this is an area where you have to train more and make that capacity faster. So in my modest opinion, I think it's about more the function than the phenotype and how the trainability, and again, the muscle plasticity, which is, it's just incredible. The muscle plasticity at the cellular level, it's great. It's great. And also how those muscles work and how can it improve. One thing that I forgot to mention specifically for triathlon is that it's very typical to see athletes who might think that their muscle fibers for running are not as good as for cycling, right? How many times we hear about triathletes who they say, oh, that the running part is that kills me. I'm not very good at running. You know, I'm very good cycling, but the running part is the one that kills me, right? And how many times we hear that all the time, right? Well, is that, you know, and that athlete might think that, oh, my specificity of the muscle fibers running are not as good as a biking. Well, actually, what I've seen all the time is like what kills that athlete is the running, is the biking, not the running. Because the biking, that athlete is not very good and needs to improve a lot, biking, not running. And I've seen this in quite athletes. So this is why it's important to make sure that it's more the way you stimulate and the way you train those fibers more than the phenotype.
Yeah.
As an example, I was telling you, Timothy O'Donnell came to the lab once, you know, like a couple of years ago, 3 years ago. And after having some years that he was not doing very good, he came and said, my running is not good. I think I'm getting killed running because my performance decreased. I'm very good at biking. And this is, I'm saying this example because he's a very experienced triathlete, right? So this is why we see this in the most experienced triathletes. And the fact it was the opposite, you know, his major weak point was the biking, not the running. And that's where we worked specifically on his biking and improve his metabolic efficiency biking so that he can be fresher on the running. And yeah, that year in Kona, I don't know if it was third or second or fourth, I remember, I have a memory for that. But yeah, he really improved a lot, his performance, by training better the biking, where he thought it was the other way around. You know, so these things happen at any kind of level, whether you're a recreational triathlete or the highest level in the sport.
Did training better for Timothy O'Donnell include less high intensity and more zone two training by any chance?
Yes, that's what I recommend. I sat down with him and his coach, right? And I highly recommend it to make those adjustments.
Right. All right. That's a really cool example. Now, finally, let's finish with the rapid fire question. So these are just one sentence answers. So they're quick and short. The first one is, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to endurance sports?
So I really like George Brooks' book of Exercise Physiology and Bioenergetics. It's a great book. And another book that I really like a lot is the Exercise Metabolism book, which was edited by, I think, Mark Hargraves.
And what's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
Well, I mean, within success, I didn't, you know, I might be successful one thing, but not another, right? But I think that perseverance and resilience and just kind of, this is a marathon, long-term things. There's nothing in a short-term is going to happen. It's about keep pushing it.
And finally, who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
To me, I really look at, I mean, I've been always admiring at a professional level, right? As a scientist, George Brooks, you know, someone who was, you know, been always 25, 30 years ahead of the rest. And never gave up, and he's been proving a lot of things. And we most of the things that we know nowadays in exercise physiology and metabolism is because of his work.
All right, perfect. Finally, you're on Twitter, so people can follow you there. I think that's probably the best place. So what's your Twitter handle?
Yeah, it's Dr. Inigo.
Great. And you post a lot of great things, including a lot of things about your research in medicine and cancer research and so on. So it's a highly recommended follow for those that are on Twitter, I would say. But I just want to thank you so much, Inigo, for taking the time. I know you have been very busy lately, so I really appreciate it and want to thank you for coming on the Triathlon Show.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Mikhail, I'm sorry. I mispronounced.
I pronounced Michael, actually.
Michael, sorry. I'm sorry. But yeah, thank you so much, Michael. And it's been an honor. And thank you so much for having me and your podcast. I really appreciate it. My pleasure.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. I honestly would say that this is one of the most interesting interviews I've done all year, well, all time really, but definitely one of my favorites from 2020. There are just really a lot of really fascinating things there to dig into. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com and including some links to related papers that Inigo has been involved in. Not surprisingly, the topic of all of them are related to the cellular metabolism in athletes of different levels, from world-class world tour cyclists to less fit individuals. On Thursday, we have another Q&A coming out as usual. And next Monday, I interview coach Ian Armiger. And the topic for that will be swimming and swim training and performance. So stay tuned for that. It was a really fun discussion that I had with Ian. Lots of really good tips. And I'm sure that you will enjoy that too. Also, before we go, do remember to check out the training camp page on scientifictriathlon.com. If you're interested in coming to Mallorca in April 2021, training with a bunch of really, really nice athletes of all abilities, from super fast to beginners, and everybody is welcome and we will cater to everybody. We have plenty of coaches on the location to help with forming different bike groups and so on. So really, there is everybody is invited and will have a great time, learn a lot about triathlon and improving their triathlon performance, and just having a week of fun in a great location, some of the best cycling in the world there on Mallorca. So check that out on scientifictriathlon.com/camp and apply if you are interested. And do keep in mind that we have COVID-19 refund policies. Read them through, but they are pretty extensive. So this is a very, very minimal risk to sign up for the camp. Big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Go and take their free online sweat test to get a personalized hydration strategy. And remember, today, if you're listening to this on Monday the 30th, is Cyber Monday, and you can get 20% off your electrolyte supplements with the code TTSFriday20, that is 20, TTSFriday20. And if you order for more than 100, then you also get a free microfiber towel. And Roka is also running their sales on roka.com. So check out if there's anything that you are in need of. If it's a wetsuit, then I would highly recommend going to Roka. If it's a tri suit, same sort of thing. If it's eyewear, whether it's sunglasses for sports performance or casual eyewear, Roka is the place to go. They just have a really wide range of products and they are all exceptional. If the product you're looking for is not on sale, on regular sale, or on a low discount, then you can get a 20% discount with the promo code that you can find on roka.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.